How precious is the book divine by inspiration given? We might feel like questioning such a statement with a chapter like Genesis 11, with a list of names, the generations of Shem. It's one of those difficult passages. We've encountered one before in the fifth chapter of this book of Genesis, where the names were equally unpronounceable and there were more of them. What do we make of a passage like this? Well, it has been given by inspiration to us. And while we don't want to spend hours digging into the names and their meanings and the significance of their placement in this history, the point that is being made for us here is highlighted by that phrase that we have encountered before in our studies in Genesis. And it's the phrase with which verse 10 opens. These are the generations. Or we could translate it alternatively, this is what Shem produced. Within the book of Genesis, it calls attention to a new section, we could say, or a new idea, or a new emphasis. And it is probably the latter that is the case here. The first encounter that we have with this phrase is in the account of the creation of the heavens and the earth. And we're told that the heavens and the earth produced. And from that point, that initial figurative use of the term, the phrase always refers to the generations, the offspring of a certain individual. In this case, it's the generations of Shem. Why Shem? Why are we brought to focus upon this particular son of Noah? Well, let me go back a little bit first. And that is to observe that we've already come through many generations in the history of the world. And at certain points in that history, significant events have taken place. Of course, the history begins with the creation of the heavens and the earth and everything that populates this world. It begins with Adam and Eve and their descendants. And the next great event, the next significant event that takes place that has a global significance is, of course, the event of the flood. Interestingly, within the genealogies that we have, that event takes place after 10 generations. The world has become desperately wicked, so that the thoughts, the motives of mankind were only evil continually. And God brought about then the destruction of the world. A great upheaval as the world was flooded and virtually all life upon it was destroyed at the judgment of God upon the wickedness of mankind. Mankind had been told to fill the earth and subdue it. And certainly he had filled it, but not by populating it, but rather he filled it with violence, the scriptures tell us. And so God responds with this violent upheaval of the world, destroying the majority of mankind, saving but a remnant, but one man and his three sons, his wife and their wives. And then we have the passing of generations once again until another significant event takes place. Another global event, if you like. And that's the event that we were considering the last time our thoughts were in this book in verses 1 through 9 of chapter 11. It is the event that took place at the Tower of Babel. And this great event then takes place where a significant upheaval and a judgment of God upon the wickedness of men, their desire to do their own thing, go their own way, their desire to ignore God. And God judges them and God disperses them over the face of the whole world. But God, you see, in the midst of all of these things that are going on, the flood, the dispersion of Babel, is still working out his purposes. He saved a family at the flood, and in his mercy, he didn't destroy the world at Babel. But rather, we see him picking out from the generations of Noah a son to whom the promise is given. We get a hint of that, well, more than a hint of it, really, in chapter 9 of Genesis. You remember how Noah's son had gone into the drunk Noah's tent and had observed his nakedness and had boasted about this to his brothers, and how they had gone in then and covered their father and showed honour to him. Noah wakes from this and discovers what has happened. And in chapter 9 and verse 25, we're told that he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." We noted at the time in our studies that this wasn't just a knee-jerk reaction to what had happened. Had that been a case, the curse would obviously have been upon Ham, not Canaan, upon the son who had committed the crime and not the son's son. But in God's sovereignty, Noah's utterance would be providing us with a background to events that would unfold in the history that would follow. But he goes on and he says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." Notice that blessing. "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." Now that second part of that phrase is significant, because it's a phrase that carries weight as we work our way through Genesis. And particularly, we'll discover it becoming a repeated phrase, except the name changes. There is the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And what does that signify to us? Well, it signifies God's faithfulness to his promise. And that's what we find here too. "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." The promise is that which was spoken in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. Speaking to the serpent, God says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel." The seed, the offspring of the woman, was to be the conqueror of the serpent. He would be the destroyer of evil and the deliverer of those who, through weakness, have succumbed to temptation and find themselves ensnared by sin. The seed was to come. And the promise of God then, to which he is consistently faithful, is the promise of this deliverer. He spared the world in the days of Noah in order that the deliverer would come and provide not just a temporal salvation, but an eternal salvation. And that is what we find here as these generations of Noah spread and the nations begin as their wickedness increases and their refusal to obey God is observed, as God pronounces his judgment and sends his punishment by confusing their language and forcing them to obey him in dispersing and filling the earth. In all of this, God is active to fulfill his promises. And so the focus falls upon the line of promise. You see, we've already encountered the descendants of Shem. We've had it in chapter 10 and verses 21 and following. In that we have a broader genealogy given to us, where we're not following one line from father to son to grandson to great-grandson, but a number of brothers are named and branch off, and we're given a broader genealogy there. Here, our attention is drawn to something of significance. These are the generations of Shem. It's a marker. It's a flag. It says, pay attention. These are the generations of Shem. And why Shem, not Japheth? Why Shem, not Ham? Because Shem is the one to whom the promise is given. It's not given in the same way as God reiterated the covenant he made with Abraham with his sons Isaac and Jacob. There's a very definite place, a point in each of those men's lives where the promise that was given to Abraham is confirmed to Abraham's son and his grandson. We don't find this here. It isn't that God pauses, that God somehow takes Shem aside and says to him, you will be the line of promise. No, it's the way that Moses is marking out for his readers, who are Israel, their history. He's telling them their background, and he's focusing in then upon God's particular providence in their history. These are the generations of Shem. This is the line of promise. These are the people through whom the living God is going to fulfill his promise to Adam and Eve. The seed, the offspring, will come. And then we have then this list of names. There's a very particular formula that is followed. When a man had lived a certain amount of time, he fathered a son, and after that point he lived a further number of years and had other sons and daughters. And so it follows through one after the other. We saw that same pattern in chapter 5. In chapter 5 we were alerted to a change part of the way through. Well, not really a change, but one individual stood out from the rest. And we spent some time looking then at Enoch, who, unlike the others, didn't die, but was caught up to heaven. Here in this list of names, there's no change throughout the list. It's the same formula over and over and over again, though we do observe that the numbers get smaller. Shem was 100 years old when he fathered Arpachshad. And then he lived for another 500 years. And then we discover that the point at which these men are fathering their sons becomes much earlier, 35, 30, 34, 32, 29. We also observe that the length of time that they live gets shorter and shorter until it becomes something that more closely resembles what we are used to. From 500 years, it goes down to 400 years, to 209 years, to 119 years. Now, there are some variations in there. When we get down to Terah, he lived 70 years before he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Twice as long as the generations that had gone before him since Shem. But it highlights the fact that when we come to Abraham, and as the story unfolds, a story with which you're all familiar, and we discover that the years pass and he has no child, this becomes of increasing concern. Because he's old. He advances beyond the normal age when children could be expected. And yet, he was in the line of promise. Indeed, this genealogy focuses at its conclusion upon Terah. It's interesting that it should focus here. I guess we're so familiar with the stories of Genesis, particularly with the key figures of Genesis, that we would expect it to focus immediately upon Abraham. Verse 27, you see, we get this flag being waved again, don't we? Now, these are the generations of Terah. But we would expect it to have gone one generation further. We would expect the phrase, now these are the generations of Abraham. It's interesting that it starts here with Terah. Now, there may be a good reason for that, because here in these concluding verses of chapter 11, we have a number of names and relationships presented to us. We're told that Terah fathered Abraham, Nahor, and Haran, and that Haran fathered Lot. Okay, we know about Lot. He plays a significant part in the history of Abraham. We're going to come across Lot many times over the following weeks. Haran, this is Abraham's brother, the son of Terah, died in the presence of his father Terah, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abraham and Nahor took wives. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. So we have Abraham's brother marrying his niece. Now, this may be a forerunner to the law that would appear in the nation of Israel, where when a brother died without having produced any offspring to inherit his portion of the land, then his brother would take his wife as his own, and have offspring in the dead brother's name to perpetuate that particular family line. And that may be what is happening here. Haran has died, and Haran's brother then takes Haran dies in the presence of his father. Nahor takes a wife, and it is the daughter of his brother, in order to extend then that line within the family name. That may be what is going on here. On the other hand, this seems like a rather dysfunctional family, if you ask me, because one of the things we don't have explained here is something that does come up later. Isn't it interesting that it talks about Terah taking Abraham, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abraham's wife? Because you see, Sarai was his daughter. Yes, Abraham married his half-sister. I can't think of a reasonable explanation for that happening at this point. But we have all of these names being given to us under the banner, you see, of these other generations of Terah. And of course, there's more to it than that, because yes, Terah is the father of Abraham and Sarai. He's the grandfather of Lot, who plays a significant part, though he's not, strictly speaking, within the line of promise. But Terah is also the great-grandfather of Rebekah, who becomes Isaac's wife. And he is the great-great-grandfather of Leah and Rachel, who become Jacob's wives. And so within this family, we have the core of Israel. Here they are. They're all together in these few verses from 27 and following, the generations of Terah. They're highlighted for the Israelites who were reading the story of their history. And Terah took Abraham, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. Of course, an Israelite sitting in his tent or standing before the tabernacle of meeting in the plains of Moab, as Moses recounts their history, he's standing there on the border of Canaan. And he's thinking to himself, oh, Terah, my great, 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 however many generations it was, grandfather, was on his way to the land of Canaan. To the land that would be the land of promise. The land, you see, that Canaan would have to relinquish to the Israelites. The cursed Canaan, who would come under the judgment of God for his lawlessness, for his vile lifestyle. Here it is for these Israelites as they're there preparing to enter the promised land. This is part of their history, and this is God's sovereignty throughout then these pages in the ebb and flow of human life and existence. God is at work, and it's when we draw together generations, one after another, and compress them all onto one page. It takes that sometimes for us to make these connections and see God's hand at work and to observe that our lives are not wandering aimlessly. We're not meandering like a river that changes its bed when floods come and takes a different direction and seemingly without any purpose. No, God is in control. Book of Proverbs tells us as much. He rules and he controls and he governs the hearts of kings. He causes it to go. He causes the channel of their life to flow in the way that he wants it to. And we see this here. No call has been given specifically at this point that this particular family line should go to the land of Canaan. But somehow Terah starts out from Ur of the Chaldeans and begins this journey in this direction. And it will be for Canaan, for Abraham, to receive a specific call and a specific promise to enter that land, that it would be his and his descendants forever. But what then can we gather? What can we glean from this other than these niceties of genealogies that I've pointed out and the interesting mishmash of relationships in Terah's family? Well, simply this, that God is sovereign. In all of these histories that we've seen, these significant events and the mundane. You see, it's not just that at times of worldwide flood that God is specifically in control. It's not just that he comes down from heaven to observe the wickedness of men when it has reached a height in which they are storming the gates of heaven by their own ingenuity. It's not just then that God is interested in what is going on in the lives of men. But it's in the mundane of our lives, in the begettings, in generation following generation, God is interested and God is in control and God has a purpose, and sometimes his purpose isn't what we expect. You know, one of the things that comes out interestingly in the book of Genesis is the choices that God makes for the promise. It's kind of hidden here, but if you compare Genesis chapter 11 with Genesis chapter 10, you observe that some of the names that are given here weren't the first offspring of the particular father. But God has chosen them to be the recipients of promise and to maintain the line of promise. Well, of course, we get that particularly, don't we, in, for example, Jacob and Esau. Who's the firstborn? Esau. Who receives the promise? Jacob. It's countercultural. We may think in our modern climate, well, that's reasonably fair. Why should the oldest always get the most? But in their culture, that was unthinkable. We even find it right at the end of the book of Genesis. When Joseph brings his son to Jacob for blessing, what does Jacob do? He crosses his hands. Isn't that interesting? You see, God doesn't do things the way that we expect. And his choices are not the choices that we expect. And that's true in our lives as well. That we can think that we know the mind of God. And at times, God chooses an entirely different route and an entirely different plan for us. And we need to rest in that. The book of Proverbs tells us, doesn't it, in chapter 3... Do not lean on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him. And it's when we're able and willing to readily embrace the providence of God in our lives that we can truly be at peace. He is working out his purposes. You see, this is just the beginnings, his choosing. Shem out of his brothers, and Terah and Abraham. These are just the beginnings of the seed of the woman coming into the world, the seed of the woman who would bless the nations, and through whose work, through whose life, through whose sacrificial death in conquering Satan, we have been blessed. So let us submit to God, and let us submit to his sovereignty in our lives, even when it surprises us and when it doesn't make much sense to us. Let us remember God sits on his throne, and he will be faithful to his promise.